it is a great pleasure to have Eleni Capiali today for my nostalgia interview. And Eleni, now we've known each other for, it must be about a decade.
Yeah. You were a senior tutor. I think these were our first interactions were with you as senior tutor dealing with student cases.
Oh, I'm relieved, because I was worried for a minute that you were going to say that, yes, somebody once said to me in an interview, because I was senior tutor, and the first time they met me was in that capacity.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, where is this going? But but you're right, I was senior tutor for years and dealing with students' pastoral concerns. Gosh, that takes me back. And so you've been at Kent for how many years, Eleni?
Almost 11, since 2013.
Yeah. And of course, now, I know you in sort of two capacities. One, of course, is in linguistics, and we'll talk about that. But also, of course, we bumped into each other at the cinema for a film that was very linguistics-laden, as I recall. What was it? American Fiction, earlier this year.
Yeah, it was a good film.
Is a big thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a continuum of interests, between my research interests and my actual passions and hobbies in life. So film is definitely a big part of that. I've used it in my research. I've used like film dialogues in my research because it's really interesting to see how fictional dialogue works, how fictionalized dialogue works, and how much it reflects natural dialogue and all that. But of course, I'm really passionate about storytelling and generally like fiction stories, all types of fiction, film and TV. It's my hobby.
Do you find that sometimes, I mean, I do this with my research, that you sometimes don't know the line. And if there is a line, it's a very permeable one, or maybe it's an absent one between the professional and the personal.
Absolutely.
And that allows us to get through. Because when people say to me sometimes, oh, where are you going on holiday? Or you must be looking forward to a break. And actually that fills me with horror because the idea of switching off, and maybe it's a professional, you know, sort of it's a coping mechanism even, but actually I no longer know the line of demarcation between all the many different the different hats, if you like, that
exactly.
I wear.
Exactly. It's exactly the same for me. And I think it's a blessing in some way, because sometimes work doesn't feel like work. It feels like, yeah, I'm doing the thing I'm passionate about. But at the same time, yes, there is also the, well, life-work balance, and do you ever switch off? Which, yeah, I don't think I do. You know, there's always like the little linguist in me noticing things and thinking about my research. But no, that's fine to an extent.
Well, you know, it's true, because it also means that even when I go to the cinema, and also so I don't know what the perception is of like people who work at the cinemas, because they see me all the time. But of course, they don't necessarily know that I also sort of do all these reviews and so on. So it's like the way that we're often pigeonholed and people compartmentalise us. But as you were sort of suggesting, of course, there are lots of other things going on, which, you know, maybe we can see the complete picture or different part. People in our families or our work colleagues or our friends or people we went to school with all see those different facets and don't always see the full picture.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah, and yeah, again, I'm bringing linguistics in, but it's all our different identities and all the different networks of people that we associate with. But there's always something, there's something permanent there too, which is like your core personality, core interest, like the things I won't shut up about, they're always there in all of my different...
Well, absolutely, don't shut up about them in this, because we'll get to that, to those core passions. But do you want to say a little bit about the sort of research and teaching that you do? Because obviously linguistics is something that is one of the hats, a very big hat that you wear.
Yeah, and it's extremely broad and interdisciplinary as well. So where I sit is the area of communication pragmatics. So that's my main background. But I also have a background in discourse analysis with links to pragmatics, and it has to do with ideologies and discourses in the public sphere, in the media, and so on. There's a bit of philosophy of language too in what I do, because my PhD and my PhD supervisor as well has a philosophy of language background. So there's a bit of that. So there's philosophical pragmatics, but also discoursey pragmatics, sociolinguistics as well, to some extent. So it touches upon what happens in society. We have a reading and research group that I've been running for several years now. I think, since 2015 or something, collaboratively with colleagues at Christchurch University, which is called Discourse Power in Society. And that tells you a lot about what we do as a group and what dots we connect as a group, because we look into, again, how discourses shape society and how society is shaped and how discourse is shaped by current trends in society, how power works, power relations, hegemonic discourses, all that.
Well, I have to ask that question then, because you're talking about those current trends. Mm. And of course, in that respect, I'm guessing that it would be impossible for your younger self, even your pre-PhD self then, to have imagined that you'd be doing what you're doing now, because from everything that I'm picking up from what you're saying, is that there's that sense of building on various sort of networks, communication agencies, discourse, which in that sense is impossible to predict, certainly, you know, decades in advance.
Yeah. So the specifics of what we're looking into right now. So right now, for example, my main project, which was Leverhulme, British Academy Leverhulme project, that ended at the end of 2023, but we're continuing on it and we'll be trying to get more funding to do it as a networking grant as well. The core of it was offensive language, taking offense, negotiating offense, attributing offense in public discourse as well. How big this was going to be right now, you know, they're talking about the culture wars and wokeness, and I'm putting air quotes here for all these things, because they are the terms themselves are debatable and they need a lot of discussion. But yeah, this I could have never imagined how big this would be, how much this would shape modern politics. It's amazing. But at the same time, I kind of feel there's a lot of continuity in what I've been doing, even since I was at school. So, like, my interests, like, they all link up. I can very clearly see this kind of continuity, which is really interesting as well. But, of course, you never know what is going to be the exact thing.
No, and two things there, because we're recording this, first of all, on the day before a general election. Mm-hmm. The paradigms with which we work, you know, and is, you know, everything sort of feels a bit liminal at the moment. But also, you mentioned school. Am I right in thinking that you grew up in Greece?
In Greece, yeah. Indeed. So school and undergraduate studies I did in my hometown, which is Patras. It's in the middle west of Greece, the top of the Peloponnese. Seaside town, nice university town, had a very nice modern university. I went from school straight to uni there, where I did a four-year degree called philology, which is what you do in Europe, which means that it includes classics, literature, and linguistics. And in your third year, you specialize in one of them. So I chose linguistics.
And then you came here. Did you do your PhD in the UK?
Yes. So I came to the UK for a MPhil at the University of Cambridge, and I stayed on for my PhD there. So I was in Cambridge for 5 years. And then I was very briefly in Leeds doing a teaching fellowship for like 6 months, and then Kent since. So it's been, yeah. Kent has been the longest.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you mentioned that growing up in a seaside town.
Yeah.
And tell me a bit about what it was like then growing up in Greece, because I have a sister who's, she's a classicist who loves the chance to go to Athens or to Greece at any opportunity. And what was it like to grow up there in terms of, you know, things like childhood memories, what you remember doing, whether, because we're talking about film, you know, what were the sort of things that really motivated you when you were growing up?
Yeah, I think I had a very idyllic childhood, because I grew up in a little village, which was a bit further away from the main town. And I grew up mainly with my grandparents, who were farmers. So it was on a farm, roaming around, free range, you know. Lots of free play, lots of freedom. But at the same time, I had a very interesting duality there, because even though it was my grandparents, the kids from the neighborhood, they're all kids of farming families. Like, a few of them didn't even finish school. It was like that level of, like, not very educated, but, you know, people working the land and so on and so forth. But my parents, who are social climbers, they're both academics. So there was a split there where there was a part of my family, my parents, who lived in their own little, like, enclosed, they had an apartment full of books. I didn't live there. I lived with my grandparents because they had to rent a tiny apartment just to put their books in, so before we were able to have our own house. And they had their little world and was full of intellectuality and intellectuals and books. And then my main world was the farm and, like, running around and, you know, hanging out with people who were nothing to do with education. So there was that very interesting.
But it's like people who, and I know those who, for example, they might have parents, actually, even in some cases, maybe both parents, who are like in the church, for example, and they're like, I want nothing to do with this. And they're sort of very clear that, you know, they resist it.
Yeah.
And then you meet them years later, or maybe they do a theology degree or something. Yeah. You think, oh, that's interesting. Or they then are ordained. Yeah. And you're thinking, hang on, you're the last person.
Yeah.
And then before I finish the sentence, I think, hang on a minute, you were reacting against it, but in the end you become your parents.
Yeah.
Is that similar to you, that you not reacted, but you were saying that you were doing something, you were living a different sort of life on the farm, but now, of course, you're an academic. So did they see it coming? Did you see it coming?
Yes, I think there was some rejection. It was really funny because my mom is a philosophy professor, so I was rejecting her more than my dad, who works with politics, political history. I really loved my dad's side of things. But with my mom, I always had, you know, there's this usual mother-daughter kind of thing. It was like, what are you doing? You're just sitting there discussing the meaning of life. Who cares about the meaning of life? I was saying things like that up until I got into Cambridge and realized that what I'm doing is philosophy of language. So, yes, there was definitely something of that sort. But there wasn't, I don't think there was ever a rejection of their profession or what they were doing. I was actually, I thought it was really cool. And they would take me to conferences, my mom especially. Yes, I would go to all those philosophy conferences when I was 8 or 9, and I would sit there listening to people analyzing Plato. But it was an environment I felt comfortable in. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed conferences, especially as a kid, like going around seeing all those academics. And also, I think as at school, I really liked, like, my favorite thing at school is when we had to do projects, like when we had to put together information, do our own research, do like the more creative side of creative science, the researchy side of things. From very early on, like, I have some notes from my maybe third grade where it was like, I am going to write a paper on the planets. And I took it really seriously. And I was like, which wasn't required at school. It was just me. It was like me writing a paper, I guess, because that was what my parents were doing. So, yeah, no, I there wasn't a big rejection. There might have been some questioning, especially with philosophy, which is very ironic, but not a really big rejection of what they were doing.
Because there is that thing, isn't there? I've mentioned this in a few conversations, and I'm sure it's a term that I haven't invented, but retrospective causality. In other words, when you're younger, and even now, you know, you're often thinking, where will I be in 10 years' time? What are my plans? What am I what am I moving towards? And sometimes we know, sometimes we don't, or sometimes we have these ridiculous ambitions, and we know we're not going to fulfil them, but they still drive us because they represent what we want to do. And when we look back, though, and the older you get, I suppose sometimes you look back and you think, oh, actually, there was a point to it all. Because at the time, you may not have imagined that you'd be an academic. Mm-hmm. But it's easy for me, as soon as you said that your parents are both academics, I'm thinking, ah, it all makes sense. But actually, it makes sense now, sitting here at, you know, in 2024. But I'm guessing that it's not as though you had this, like, great plan, everything mapped out, that you'd go to Cambridge, and then you come to Kent, and you do all of these things that you're doing. But do you kind of feel almost the inevitability that this, you know, and it's no doubt because of the influence of your parents that you should do what you're doing, rather than, for example, the farm? Because, you know, that was a big part of your life at a certain time.
Yeah,
but presumably, you know, that is, you know, that you've moved on from all that.
That's true. Well, the one thing I knew for sure I wanted to be doing since I was a child was be a teacher. So I remember, like, our play was me gathering all my cousins and the neighborhood kids around. It was like, right, now we're playing school and I'm the teacher. And I don't think they really enjoyed it, but I had some kind of authority in that group because I was one of the older kids. So they would just sit there, we would play school, I would be the teacher. So I knew that from very early on. Like, I think I was 7 or 8 and I had decided I want to be some kind of teacher. So I'm glad I was able to do that. I think that was always the plan. But yes, I never knew which level I would be teaching at. I remember thinking kindergarten teacher, then I was thinking secondary school teacher, which is what I actually trained for in my undergraduate studies. Academic teacher, best of both worlds, I guess. I feel very fortunate that you get to do the research, but you also get to teach.
So when you go to those conferences now, do they feel very different? Or have you been protected from having been exposed to them at a very young age? Because they can, I mean, I remember going to my first conferences, and sometimes you're thinking, do I really belong here? Do I really fit in here? No. These, you know, people, sometimes, you know, you see people, a different side to people. Mm. Because when you're teaching students, then obviously there's a very clearly set out dynamic and job thing. When you go to a conference, suddenly you see somebody who... Yeah. It might be a wonderful teacher, but my first ever experience of an academic conference was some very well-known academic who thought that he had double the time that he had and said, well, I'm just going to speak at double the length because I'm going to get this out. And I remember thinking, I don't think that's a very good idea. And he hurtled through this talk and was effectively like, I don't care if you can't follow me. You know, this is my talk and I'm not deviating from the script. Mm-hmm. And I remember coming away thinking, gosh, there are some very eccentric people in this. Mm-hmm. And please don't get me wrong. I would certainly include myself in that. But I remember at the time thinking, gosh, this is an initiation to a strange world. Yeah. But before long, of course, I'm thinking, well, but I am also very part of that world. So mm-hmm. what was it like for you having been exposed to that as a young person? Do you find that it's sort of been normalised?
Yeah, I think so. But also, remember, it was philosophy conferences. So no, you know, not to imply anything about philosophers, but you will see all these sorts of things, like people who will go on or people who will... very impressively improvise the whole talk and it will still make sense and it's like extremely impressive. Or people who read out a paper, which none of these last two things happens in linguistics conferences. So when I went to my first linguistics conference as an undergrad, I think, as an undergrad and then as a postgraduate student as well, the first thing I noticed is how much more structured they were and how much, by that time, of course, there was PowerPoint too, so everything was there, the data was there, the PowerPoint was there, and people were just explaining the research really briefly and succinctly most of the time. So, it was, I think the trajectory was from something that could be anything and could be really surprising and you sit there as like, oh, what's next? To something a lot more structured and predictable.
Because I found, and actually thinking back to my first academic conference, or certainly when I was doing my PhD, and I remember that sometimes the more professional or sort of, the more renowned the person, the more cluttered and what is the word that you use there in that sense of sort of, you know, sort of unstructured, free-flowing, you know, the talk might be. So there were some really big names who were just sort of making it up as they went along. But because they were big names, they were allowed to.
Yeah.
And I'm in no way criticising that. But then there would be some of those younger people who were starting out who were sort of reading it very sort of methodically and making sure that they didn't deviate from word and were worried that if they did say like one word wrong, that they'd be picked up on it. Was in reality, you know, if you go into multiple papers, sometimes you're not there for the minutiae for every word. I mean, if you're reading an article, well, of course it matters. Then, you know, especially as you're working in philology or linguistics, well, obviously it matters that you say the right thing in the right way. But at a conference, I've learned now that actually sometimes it is better to, you know, have a point and a structure. People get what they paid for, as it were. But at the same time, you also have a bit of fun with it because I can learn from something I read. But if somebody's talking to me, I'm not going to take all of it in the same way. And I don't think anybody can be expected to, because you pick up the mood, you pick up the form of delivery. I spend more time analysing somebody's mannerisms and somebody, you know, what they're exhibiting, perhaps more than the actual content. And in some cases, they may be putting all these wonderful ideas and terms I've never heard of, and I can't catch up with it. I can't pick up on it. Because if I was reading it, I'd be able to say, let me just look up that word or whatever it might be. So it's I suppose, particularly in linguistics, that distinction is quite sharp.
Yeah, it is. And To be honest, I do prefer to sit in talks that are still work in progress, and they present research which is still ongoing, and people may be searching for the right terms, people may be searching for the right theoretical frameworks and asking questions to the audience. I prefer that because it feels like it's something alive to someone presenting something, a paper that they've already published, for example. Because, yeah, I can go and read that paper. It's done. It's finished. So, yeah, I mean, that's the kind of distinction that I see in conferences. And I don't know if I'm doing it because I'm the type of academic who will always do the former. So I'm always presenting work in progress and things that are not complete because I really need the feedback. And maybe that's why. That's what I prefer hearing as well. But yeah.
But I'm just thinking because American Fiction was exactly about that, wasn't it? Tell me because anyway, for anyone listening to this, so what had happened is I go to the Curzon very regularly, and many other cinemas as well, and I think on the day that it came out on the Friday, you were there, and it, what a perfect fit in terms of everything that you've just said so far. But that whole idea of the way that we perhaps embody a different voice or a different identity or a different persona or a different ethnicity or a different gender, all those sort of
And
things
the
that were there.
expectations of audiences, that was again that film, it was really interesting, like what the audience expectations are and even like the publishers and the editors' expectations are, just because you have those identity features. Yeah, it was a really clever film, that one.
Do you kind of find that those films, there are plenty of them for my subject as well, and they're laughable, and I've sort of grown to love them because they don't in any way mirror what it feels like to be a religious studies academic. But I also get the point that if a film was a bit more true to life, well, frankly, I don't think the life of a religious academic is enough, is exciting
Exactly, to
enough
make
to
a film of
warrant a
it.
cinematic treatment. So, of course, there are always, when you have professors of theology, religious studies, they're always a bit cranky. They're always promoting faith. Now, that's the interesting thing. And that they're always on some sort of spiritual journey, or they're mystical, or they've got some really big sort of traumatic thing in their life, and they're in touch with the divine. And I watch that and think, if any of the things I've just said were to be communicated in any of my lectures, I think people would, rightly so, have reason to be concerned because those are the things that we bracket out. So the representation of people in my profession on film bears no resemblance to anything, at least I don't think it does, in the day-to-day world. So, when you see those portrayals in film, for example, in your subject area, what do you get from them?
Well, I don't know. I enjoy the thing with me is like I enjoy fiction, so it depends how well written it is. I don't get that bothered about the portrayal not matching. Okay, so for example, the film Arrival, right? So she's a linguist and she's asked to go and figure out how to communicate, how to interpret an alien language. Yes, this would never happen. No linguist has this ability. I mean, there are some things, because they did have consultants on that film and they had linguists on that thing. There are some things that are accurate about how we approach fieldwork and fieldwork with an unknown language. So there were some accuracies that we enjoyed watching, but the rest of it, of course, is completely, it's sci-fi. It's also something, it had to do with psychological memory and all that, and it was really interesting. So I really enjoyed that film, for example. I was noticing how she had an amazing house and she had an amazing office. And I was like, yeah, I don't know if you can do that as an academic linguist, but you can afford all that, or you can have like the luxury to go away from your job for months on end to do some very interesting field work, without first having to jump through the hoops of applying for a million grants and so on and so forth. But who cares? The story was great. You enjoy the storytelling. You enjoy the sci-fi side of things, the psychological side of things, and some interesting little sprinkles of linguistics in there.
And no, you're right. And the way in which there always seemed to be this spate of films in the 90s. I've had architects on the programme, and I think of like Richard Gere in Intersection. There are hundreds of other examples I can think of. But where the character might be an architect and they live in these immaculate houses, but you're sort of watching it thinking, that's interesting because it doesn't quite mirror you know, anybody I know who works in these sort of areas, it's like, are their lives really that spacious? And you know, you might be an architect, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you live in a palatial environment. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, you can be a theologian, doesn't mean to say that you commune with the divine. But you're right. And somebody once said to me, who's although maybe in America it's different, and an academic over there, who I've had some engagements with over the years, she said to me once, do you have students round to your house sometimes for, you know, for drinks and for, you know, at the end of a module or the end of a semester? Do the students come over for drinks and all that sort of thing? And I'm thinking, not even close. Mm-hmm. You know, and I remember just thinking, gosh,
yeah,
you know,
that doesn't fit.
Yeah. So maybe it isn't an American thing, but that's a really interesting observation.
It might be, because that particular thing, going to Cambridge was a big cultural shock for me. Obviously, a lot of the things were a lot different from what I was used to as an undergraduate student in my university, which, by the way, is my home university. It's so similar to the University of Kent. They were founded at the same time. They have like very similar campuses. So yeah, Kent is is the type of environment that I'm very used to. But Cambridge was a shock. And in Cambridge, yeah, there were actually cases of a professor hosting, because they have college rooms. So in the college room, they would be hosting an after evening drinks and cheese and talking about linguistics with the students. And it felt like more intimate, like we were in their quarters, we were in their rooms. I can imagine it happening in the States as well, in a different tradition, but not the tradition, certainly not the tradition I was coming from.
Absolutely, those culture shocks are sometimes profound. But tell me a bit as well about, because when I was growing up, and I'm channeling this now because I do, you know, radio work and so on, but music was, I was deeply passionate about it, you know, and it was almost to the point, it was the hierarchy, almost, you know, that if a song that you liked was doing really well in the charts, then, you know, that was the thing. That, you know, we identified ourselves.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
I was never really into sports, and you know, we can come on to all of that if necessary. But for me, that was the defining thing.
Yeah,
that was absolutely the thing that mattered in relation to my friends. Like, what music do you like?
Yeah.
And how well is it performing? Almost like in terms of the corroboration of that on a national level in terms of the top 40.
Mm-hmm,
but growing up where you did in your small village, did any of that matter? Does it matter now?
Yeah, it is, of course. I think quite early on, I was fascinated by the radio. So I was in love with the radio as a medium. I think it started so I'm an only child. And there was a move in my life, so I was living with my grandparents until the age of 9. But after the age of 9, my parents managed to get their own house. So we moved there with all their books. No TV, because my mom was very... Both of them had this, like, ideological thing that, oh, TV is there to, you know, control the masses and all that. They were a bit of anarchists. So they had decided that there will be no TV in that house. So it was just endless books and the radio. And me, as an only child, just spending endless hours in my room with books and radio. The radio was, I adored it. I would listen to all those late night shows. I don't think my parents knew I stayed up so late, but there were all these chat shows, late night chat shows. And of course, songs came into that as well. So each of the producers had their favorite type of music and types of, and that's what I was following. I remember even calling in and like, I was calling in to request a song and all
can
that.
Can you remember what the songs were? Can you remember what sort of music?
Yes, I remember. Well, I mean, I went through different phases, obviously, right? So, I mean, my preteens, I don't think it was all very predictable. So my preteens were the Spice Girls and the Backstreet Boys, of course. My teens were everything rebellious. So anything rebellious, anything angry, a lot of punk rock, a lot of hard rock, metal, the whole range of like even rap and hip hop music that was protest music, I think, protest songs and all that, like very political as well. But yes, I remember, for example, you know, from Rage Against the Machine to Sex Pistols and the whole like punk scene. There was a Greek punk scene as well, which...
Well, I was going to ask, actually, the extent to which a lot of more indigenous music was played, because I know there are some radio stations, and also in France and in cinemas as well, there's a certain amount of homegrown music or film that needs to be shown, transmitted.
Yeah, it's huge, and... all the genres as well. So in Greece, yeah, you get all the genres of Western music as well, but you get some like more folksy type of artsy, folksy world type music that is quite good. Like, there were quite a few artists from that scene that I also liked. But I think growing up, because I only lived in Greece until the age of 21, so this is my experience in Greece. So up to then, especially in my late teens, early adult years, it was mostly Western-influenced music. So it would be anything on the rock spectrum, I think.
Yeah, and because I always maybe didn't really appreciate the distinction between different cultural sort of music scenes, because, you know, growing up as I did in the 80s, there were a lot of these sort of holiday, or these records that did really well when people were on their summer holidays, and they somehow made their way into the British charts, like Europop stuff. And I think a lot of stuff, like stuff you see in Eurovision these days,
is kind of that.
So it's that sense of being appropriated and exported or imported, depending on which way around you look at it. And there would be a lot of that. People would associate it with their like summer holiday romances and things. Mm-hmm. And I was growing up and I wasn't really aware of all that because I didn't do those sort of things. So I'd listen to the music, but I wasn't aware of the context. Like films, actually, that I didn't used to go to the cinema. It's ironic because I go all the time now. Mm-hmm. But I'd know all the film soundtracks and I'd know their association, but I didn't know the films that they were part of. So it's almost like it was somebody else who could do, like, I was almost listening to the outcome of the process, but I wasn't involved in the process
the context.
Itself.
It's also interesting how, I mean, my husband is British, so he grew up here, and we have very similar music backgrounds, and you know, we were listening to the same bands, but there's always like the odd song from that band that was really popular in Greece that was not popular at all here, and it wasn't charting here at all. So even though it's the same band, I was like, oh, but you know, how come you don't know that song? That was so huge in Greece. But no, it wasn't big here. So it's quite interesting, even in the same genres, even within the same bands, that there would be songs that don't match. The success doesn't match for different reasons, I guess.
Yeah, and you just said it reminded me, was it Glenn Medeiros? I was 15, summer 1988, and it was a number one, and nothing's going to change my love for you. And that was one of those songs that I think as well, in when people were regularly going around Europe, you know, summer holidays, and that song kind of epitomised what were films I've seen about that, not about that particular song, but involving, you know, 1980s or early 90s set British overseas holidays in the summer, and the way in which that sort of eclectic thing has influenced our lifestyles, our passions, our culture,
absolutely.
Our music, our film, and so on. You know, in an age before the internet, for example, when it wasn't so readily accessible.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Generally, yeah, that's another one of my passions or interests, like pop culture and how it disseminates and how it changes and what becomes prominent in pop culture and what's the current. I'm a little bit, I've got a bit of a fear of missing out with pop culture. I think I always want to be up to date with what's the current trend, what's happening now. But it's also, I think, a research interest too, like how is pop culture shaped, and micro cultures as well that relates to the overall pop culture. So yeah, I think one reason why I'm so interested is precisely because I've lived in two different countries and I've seen it develop simultaneously into different countries, slightly differently, or sometimes overlapping a lot.
Yeah, but I feel I'm learning at the moment because I would have, until a few weeks ago when I started doing some radio work where I play a lot of older stuff, which I love, and I can talk about that because I'm so passionate about it, because it's like music I grew up with, etc. But at the time I was thinking, oh, I've got to play all the current stuff I've got no interest in. But actually it's a good counterpoint, because if I'm playing the stuff from 2022 or today, then actually to play that and then do something from, I don't know, 1974 or something from the 50s, actually it makes it a bit more exciting because you've almost got the sort of, well, okay, well, let's give it a shot. And also people who are listening to the programme often will know more about and actually enjoy the current stuff. So it's almost as though I need to play that and then I can get away with my own passions. Whereas if I just played stuff from 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago, then somehow it would become so niche that people would say, well, it's like, you know, this is your music, good for you, but actually we need more of a variety.
But you can
so
also,
I can get away with more.
You can also find connections. That's the exciting thing. So you can find connections between, like, some intertextuality or connections between the things that were happening so many years ago, so many decades ago and now. So there's always like actual real connections, intertextuality, real influence, but also things that you can connect, because it's like, oh, look what was happening then, what's happening now, especially if you have something like political, a political reference, a political song, for example. That's also very
interesting. What you're saying about growing up with radio, I find insightful because it's the mood of radio that when you, because you said that you listen late at night and you remember the debates or the phone-ins, but like with conferences, sometimes you, I mean, if I think back to a conference, I don't remember each individual paper, but I will have a sort of a sense of what that person exhibited, what they epitomised, what they represented, how they came across. Like the radio, you may not remember the actual conversations or even the music necessarily, but you remember the ambience and you remember the, this is the crucial bit, the impact on you.
It felt magical. I remember I had the sense that it's this kind of medium that, I don't know, it felt like connects people and people go on there to pour their soul out. And I remember those, I might have been cheesy, but I was 10 and there were confessions, you know, they would call in and talk about like their worries in life and you could feel like a community coming together and, you know, it's people from all over and with all sorts of different backgrounds, but it gives you that sense of, something communal, something shared, something very human, something very core to humanity and communication. It was all very romantic, I think. I don't know. It was quite interesting. And not to have the TV interfere with that, not to have the easier access entertainment interfere with that, made it quite unique as an experience, I think.
Yeah, because I grew up with radio, but we didn't have very many TV channels growing up, so we all watched the same sort of stuff. And generally speaking, it would be easy to have those conversations in the school playground about, you know, because we'd often all watch the same thing.
True.
But I've kind of written TV out of my life now because I can watch things on the internet, obviously, so in a way I don't miss it.
Yeah.
But radio has always been core to me. And obviously film is something which I wasn't doing as a teenager. But it's almost as though something had to go. And if I had to let go of one media, it would be TV. Even though, I mean, I do TV work, but I can watch that otherwise. But it's the one, because radio for me is, and I think this is what coming out in what you're saying, that the one is for me, it's the intimacy, it's the personal connection. And actually, it is a bit romantic. It's also therapy, I think, as well. I'd like to think it can be, I do radio, but it can be, you know, for the presenter, but very much for the audience as well.
Absolutely.
In terms of whatever you're going through in your life, there's a voice there who can who can steer you through it.
Absolutely. That's how I feel too. Of course, nowadays we have more modern things like podcasts, which I do listen to a lot as well, because they're my commute friend. I used to read books in my commute a lot, but I've switched to podcasts in the last few years. It's just like there's something in my ears always playing.
Do you drive or use public transport?
I use the train, public transport.
Because when I used to use public transport to book, I would do reading and I'd sometimes do my diary work and so on there. But as I now drive, then so I had to make that switch. Although actually I've certainly, you know, used that as an opportunity to engage more with radio. But it's interesting how the commute, because during lockdown, some people said to me, oh, you must be relieved that at least you don't have to go into work and have to commute every day. And I was thinking that in a funny way, that was almost the best bit of it. That transitional liminal state, that transition from one environment to the other, which was never replicated by walking up the stairs in your house from one room to another. And I found that I wasn't even more productive during lockdown. So you take out a half an hour commute, but no, I felt more productive and still feel more productive now than I did during lockdown.
Absolutely. I mean, that's my constant fight, because at the on one hand, commute is a bit painful and expensive, so I do try to avoid it when I can. But sometimes I do regret avoiding it because I have no way I'm more productive at home than I am here. So I do work from home a lot in the summer. Like here, sometimes I go to Greece and I work from Greece, just visiting my family. But it's almost never as productive. And even when I work from home, it might not be home. It might be the local cafe or the local library, which unfortunately our local library has closed. And I'm so disappointed because, like, one of the reasons we moved where we moved, it's in Berstedt, the little village near Maidstone, is it had such a beautiful little quaint library that I was looking forward to using. But it closed very soon after we moved there. That was a disappointment. But yeah, so you need to change space and you need to move away from home in order to be the most productive, I think.
Yeah. I find that I'm often the solitary person in a communal space, and I thrive off that.
Oh, yeah.
In other words, and I think that's my cinema thing, because I normally always go on my own, but also people sometimes say, "Well, why go all the way to London or wherever here to watch a film at the BFI when you can just watch it on DVD?"
No,
I'm thinking, I'm really sorry. That's the same as saying, "Don't bother going into work to teach your students. Just pre-record it and they can watch it on the internet."
No. It's a completely different experience. I love going to the cinema alone. When I was an undergrad, there was the Film Society. It wasn't for students. It was the local, actually, the Film Society, the town's Film Society. And they would have a screening every Thursday evening, and I never missed the screening. And my mom used to joke and say, "It's like people who go to church, like you never miss, you know, it's like going to church every Sunday." I never missed the screening. I never looked for people to come with me. Sometimes friends wanted to come if it was a film they were interested in. I didn't care if I had company or not. I would be there every Thursday, film club. It was one of the best things of my undergrad life.
Yeah. Can you remember what sort of films you saw? Were they like international?
Yeah, they were international. Yes, they were like your art house type film, but not very niche. I mean, you know, Bergman, Tarkovsky, like the classics, and then there would be newer films coming out. I remember a lot of Iranian cinema at the time. Anything like Japanese cinema as well, out of Kurosawa, like the classics, but also anything that was coming out at the time that was considered like worth.
It's an education because I flip between the multiplex and the art house, and obviously sometimes art house cinemas will show big films like superhero films. You can't get away from them, and I end up watching them more because it's almost like, well, you know, what's the alternative? But there is an education in that, and I think it's like with the music I was saying, that if I want to get away and indulge my passion for the stuff that I grew up with, well, I also need to play the contemporary stuff, and it's that counterpoint that actually makes, you know, there's a as you say, there's something intertextual in that. Mm-hmm. Same with the cinema, that you know, I will watch an art house film, but I also need to see the big crowd pleaser. But it's not a case of preferring one to the other. It's actually the balance. Yeah. If I just watched big budget multiplex friendly fare, I feel that I was missing something. If I only saw art house films, I'd also feel this is, well, which would be my go-to, I think, really. But it's nice to have the counterpoint. Mm. And it's just finding the right balance. But if you bring somebody else into the equation, and I've been in this position when I've gone to the cinema with people, and maybe you've argued over what film to watch, and then you fudge and you compromise, and then you go with them. And then you're aware the whole time that they actually might be reacting. And I had a really quite bad experience once of somebody I was with who clearly didn't take to the film. They thought it was way too edgy, and I was convinced that they were going to walk out. And it was a very uncomfortable experience. But it actually informed my apprehension of the film. And in subsequently reviewing it, I was very aware that I wasn't just reviewing the film, I was reviewing the experience as to why somebody was reacting so badly. If I'd been there on my own, I wouldn't have cared if people had walked out or not. But you feel some responsibility if you're with somebody. Afterwards they'd say, "Why would you go and watch a film like that?" And of course, the answer is, well, don't forget, I watch everything, which is my get out. But I can also see that if you were to watch one film a year and you choose one film, goodness me, why would you have chosen that? It's quite interesting.
I mean, I'm smiling because I'm thinking my husband doesn't have like a very eclectic taste or anything. He will watch, some mainstream. He mostly watches sci-fi because that's his passion, sci-fi, fantasy. But then there's me. Sometimes I drag him into films that are mainly my interest, but I know he will enjoy. And so he has ended up enjoying lots of films that he would never have picked on his own. But sometimes I am a bit wary, like I'm thinking, oh, maybe I shouldn't have. So now, for example, the new film by Yorgos Lanthimos, the Greek director, has come out, Kinds of Kindness, and I really want to see it, but I know my husband is not going to enjoy it, so I'm trying to see where it's showing when he doesn't have to be there with me or he has something else to do that evening, because that's not a film he will want to see with me. Yeah,
it's just, how many times do you think I've seen it?
I don't know.
I've seen it twice.
Really? Did you? How did you think?
Obviously, I'll be careful what I say. I was so dumbfounded, not in a bad way, wrong-footed, actually shocked. Now, remember, I go to the cinema every night, and I came away from it, and I thought, if I'm going to review this film, goodness me. Well, actually, there was more to it, because it's quite a long film, and in the third bit, I not because the film wasn't good, but because it was quite long, and I sometimes, as I watch films quite late in the evening, I can get a bit tired.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed it very much, but I started to drift a little bit. And there were some bits in the film that were so shocking and extraordinary, I thought, and also bewildering and made absolutely no sense whatsoever, which is kind of the point. I had to watch it again. So bizarrely, and I left my keys in the cinema and I had to go back the next day. It was a long, long story. I got them back. Anyway, so I ended up, and I missed, I meant to book for one night and I booked for the wrong evening. And so I ended up seeing it two nights running in the same seat. With a different audience, a very small audience in both cases. But I think I learned as much from the people who were leaving afterwards and what they were saying as I did from the film itself. So that's why I mentioned that. All I'd say is I'd recommend it, but also it's the sort of film that sometimes you probably need to watch on your own if you think that somebody else might be disgusted, outraged by what they're
it's
watching.
Not, I think, so my husband's only contact with Lanthimos has been The Lobster, which to me is the most mainstream one. And he's still like, what is going on? Like, he's like, what is this ridiculous thing? I was like, yeah, okay. I'm not showing you any other films by this director. Yeah. He's out for you. Because, I mean, if you're not used to that style and also... it's not at all your genre. You're like, well, is it even a genre? I don't know. He's got all sorts of it. But I've seen all of his films, not just because I'm Greek, but because it's like my kind of weirdness.
Well, what I'd say is it's the sort of film then that you're either in that sense going to think it's the most incredible film in a way that is sure it... can, like, it's like being knocked over the head, you know, it bludgeons you, but you kind of feel, oh my goodness, you know, this is extraordinary stuff, and you know that you have to be part of that, and you may be disgusted by it, but you also know that's part of the allure. Somebody else will just say, sorry, this is outrageous, and wish they hadn't gone. And I think therefore that because it is going to be like Marmite, it's a film that's going to polarize people, that's one example that you perhaps need to see it on your own terms, because it is going to be, it's going to affect and impact other people in a way that then would actually take away your pleasure from the film, because you'll be quite conscious that actually they may be looking away at certain key moments, and that the conversation afterwards won't be, wasn't that an amazing film? It'll be, you know, my goodness, why did you bring me along?
I mean, speaking about this type of cinema, it does cover some needs and some, like, I like the absurdity, and like I think I'm always quite disconnected sentimentally from these films, because I see them more as thought experiments, and like the really clever thought experiments on how this works, how this works with imagery. But then, of course, there's all the other type of films which are the ones that warm your heart, and they're more accessible, and they tell stories that you can connect with. So you definitely also need to have this balance, as you were saying. I definitely love the ones that are more humane. I love the edgy ones, I definitely crave the ones that are also more human and more connected to the, like, low-key, low-concept, low-key kind of things as well. Which I think that's something like Iranian cinema does really well. Lots of Balkan cinema does really well as well. Some British, I love those cute British films that are very, again, very low key, and again, just the humanity that comes out and nothing else. No pretentiousness, or not trying to show off anything big directorially and image wise.
Yeah. But, absolutely. Yeah. No, it's the balance, that for sure. Now, as we start to wrap up, Eleni, I've got to ask this sort of question about your younger self, your present self. What do you think your younger self, growing up in a village in Greece, would have thought about where you are now and what you do now? Would they have believed it? I suppose having academic parents would have impacted on that. But by the same token, do you look back on your younger self, and you know, what sort of conversation would you have with that younger version of yourself?
Yeah, definitely. Some of it is a bit surreal. Like, I don't think I ever expected that I would live in a different country. I think even when I left for my master's degree, the plan was to always come back, like after my master's or after my PhD. But I was too happy and too comfortable here and everything. And of course, it was during the time where the recession hit really hard in Greece. So even if I wanted to go back at that stage, I don't think I would have been able to. The most surreal thing for my younger self would be that she lives full-time. She's a British citizen and she lives in the UK permanently. And now has like a British side of her family too, and my in-laws, and you know, there's this whole other culture that's part of me and part of my family now. The teaching and research, I think I could have imagined, like, precisely because my parents were academic. But at the same time, yeah, my best friend, from that time, is a sheep herder, and she's still a sheep herder. And sometimes my mom thinks back to that, because there was this time, even before leaving, where I went to Athens and I met Noam Chomsky. He was being made an honorary professor at the University of Athens, and I went there and I shook his hand, and that was like my most like fangirling moment in my life that far. And my mom was like, wow, like your sheep herder friend, you go from these extremes, like my sheep herder friend who didn't even finish primary school, to shaking Noam Chomsky's hand. And yeah, it's that so, you know, absurdity or duality of yeah.
It is. Now, I have to ask you about that then, because your friend who is a sheep herder, now, is she aware of what you're doing now, and you're aware of what she's doing? But do you find that it kind of gives a different sort of context and a better sort of context and an undergirding to what you've done, because that's your life story? But is there some sense in which her life and your life are they poles apart? Are they actually really just two different sides of the same coin?
Yeah, they're not. But like, it's always when I'm back, my cousins as well, everyone's still in the village. Like, no one, I'm the only one who's moved away. And when I'm back, it all feels the same. It all feels like home. Usually what we do is reminisce, like we think about the things we did as children. We think about what we used to play. So a lot of our conversations are like our childhood and nostalgia, and like how it used to be and what we used to do. But there's always things that will connect you with these people. And a lot of these people are family anyway, because it was a small village and like half of them were my cousins. So, I mean, it's still like, and that's another reason why you keep in touch. I mean, it's family. And yeah, you don't, okay, some things, like politically, for example, there might be things where we diverge and you like better not touch some subjects or social political subjects that you may not touch because they might be more conservative and so on. But there is something there. There's the core of us and what shapes you in childhood that's still there and still something we can go back to and have the roots and the mutual experiences.
You see, so we've talked about American fiction, but there must be, you know, if there was a film made of your life, then, you know, there would be that, you know, you're the sheep herder friend and you the philologist, the linguist, and there's a sense in which the lives would sort of cross over, or maybe actually exchange for a brief period. And you'd be living that life, she'd be living your life, and what an interesting intersection that would be, because we all need that, because I've had that. It's like on Facebook, the bit that I always enjoy is when sometimes there might be somebody that you knew from school, or maybe somebody who's got nothing to do with your professional life now, but they're in, because of you, you're the point of contact. You're the only thing they have in common. and that suddenly I might kickstart a conversation on social media, and then there's a dialogue which is fostered by two people. I'm the common connection, but they have nothing to do with each other. They live in different places. They have a different, you know, different professions, different occupations, different life stories. But suddenly they've come together because the common interest is me. And
something I may have posted. Link.
And I enjoy that. And I think, where is this going?
Because
it's almost like, you know, the two most unlikely people who could be in conversation, because there's that person who I knew 40 years ago, and there's the person who works as a barista in the coffee shop down the road, and suddenly here they are now, and they're engaging with each other, and I'm like, oh, where is this going?
Yeah. It's also the idea of degrees of separation. So there's always, like, they say, the 6 degrees of separation. So, yeah, I think when my mom was talking about my sheep herder friend in Chomsky, she was like, wow, there's 2 degrees of separation. Yeah. There's 1 degree of separation between her and Chomsky. And that's quite interesting. Yeah. And I'm the link. But yeah, the Facebook thing, I'm not a fan at all of, like, social media. But I observe, so I'm not on there and I don't usually comment or participate, but I do notice it in other friends, like yours and other friends' Facebook pages, where you get people from so many different backgrounds interacting.
Yeah, it's in a funny way, it is a kind of, I don't, maybe social engineering is not the word, but there is a sense in which, and this is the difference from radio, although radio, I suppose, would always have the interaction between the different listeners, but via the presenter, via the stage, they go through that route. But I suppose there's something a bit more go-to, and it has bad sides to it, because, of course, I'm thankfully, hopefully not on my Facebook pages, but people will use social media sometimes and they'll rant and they'll say things which are inappropriate.
Yeah, that's a bit, and it's quite divisive.
There's that element. But there is an interesting element sometimes when you can sometimes post something as random as a coffee cup. And actually, one of your former colleagues, Tamara, actually mentioned me once that it's true that if you post a picture of a coffee cup, you're probably going to get hundreds of likes and comments. Because if you say, this is my latest book, or this is my latest podcast or something, and you think, 5 likes, you know, they want me to have no interest. And that's the thing. And the things that resonate with people are not always the things that we like. What your sheepherder friend might be, might engage with, what you might engage with, may or may not be the same.
Yeah, absolutely. That's true. And but then you see what is, like, core humanity, so something that may appeal to all the people, regardless of background and so on. It's quite interesting. What are these things? Or what are the things that unite us? Yeah.
Well, I've got one more question for you, Lenny, which is that I always finish the interviews with this question. Would you consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't know, a bit of both, I would say. So I do like looking back, and I think it's like some identity work happening there. It's like, oh, okay, so let's trace back where this comes from. Let's see how this was this always meant to be? Like, what's my trajectory? So I do that a lot. But at the same time, I'm looking forward. I'm not the type of person, I'm an optimist. Despite situations and despite circumstances, I'm an optimist. So I do look ahead in the future. I do like to imagine things that I could do, things that I could do to counteract all the bad things that are happening in the world. Like, how can I be of any use? Like, I like it, like envisioning things that I can do to contribute, to help, to do something positive, to have a positive impact. So, yeah, that's usually when I look ahead in the future, yeah.
Well, on that very optimistic, forward-moving note, Lenny, thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Thank you for having me. It was great fun.